The views expressed on this program are the views of the individual broadcaster and by no means reflect the view of Wesleyan University or the WESU management. Hello, and welcome to Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, a progressive-minded radio show about faith and action, coming to you from Wesleyan University's WESU, 88.1 FM, Middletown, and WESUFM.org, providing community radio that matters. I'm Maria Johnson. I'm starting off today's episode with some audio snapshots from the Women's March on Washington, the warm reverberations of which still linger days later. The people I met, the kindred feeling, it was like a UConn Women's Victory Parade times 10. And it's left me energized and even hopeful. I'd taken the Amtrak train down just for the day. Beth Johnson from Minnesota boarded the train in Baltimore and started talking the moment she plopped down in the seat next to mine. Our friendly conversation was interrupted at one point by the woman in the seat ahead, who stood up, turned around, announced that she'd been eavesdropping, and that as a Trump supporter, she had to disagree. "We are not going backwards," she said. I just looked down, shook my head, and wouldn't engage, 'cause what's the point? But Beth politely clarified for the woman that she was afraid things would go backward, not that they were. So the woman sat back down, but from then on, Beth and I talked in quieter tones. That episode was pretty much the only sour note of the whole day. I met wonderful people from near and far. A special shout-out to the Lutheran Church of the Reformation, which provided coffee, bagels, and fruit, along with poster boards and markers for sign-making, in their community room to help start our day. The small orange and black sign I made pled, "Donald, it's not too late to change." And it drew a few awes as I walked along with it, because most of the signs were, well, sharper in tone. I'll post a bunch on the ReasonablyCatholic.com website. My next stop after breakfast was at St. Peter's Church for 9 a.m. Mass with several dozen of my fellow protesters, a lot more people than usually attend daily Mass, according to Father Kelly. And then I headed for the mall, the crowd thickening by the minute until people were pretty much standing in place, cheek by jowl, for upwards of 2 hours. And even so, there was no tension, no anger, just a feeling of participating in something important, perhaps historic. All of us, around the world, making our views known with our very bodies.
As we go marching, marching in the beauty of the day, a million darkened kitchens, a thousand millots gray.
My name is Beth Johnson. I'm from St. Paul, Minnesota.
I'm Maria Johnson.
How about that? We're family.
So, cool hat.
Thank you. It's a pussy hat. And a lot of women have them. A friend of mine made this for me, made one for my daughter, and for several of our friends who are marching in St. Paul, Minnesota.
So what does it mean to you to be doing this today?
To me, it means ensuring a future for my daughter and for my friends and their daughters. The things that we fought so hard for back in the 70s are now in jeopardy. And I want to know that the women of the future have opportunities for health care, for equal jobs, for being able to live the lives the way they choose without interference from men or from politicians.
Beautiful. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Hi, Connecticut person.
Hi.
Where are you from?
Stores.
And you responded to my Husky vest.
That's right.
Go UConn.
UConn Husky.
Go UConn. All right.
Women's basketball.
Rocks. Are you from Connecticut?
I am also from Connecticut.
Wow. You came all the way down here like I did for this.
That's right.
Why is that important to you?
Because women's rights are important. Everybody's rights are important.
Women's rights are human rights, and human rights are women's rights. This is a wonderful, enormous, peaceful, loving crowd.
It is. It's so jammed, though. I couldn't get anywhere near the thing.
That's why we're standing by this tree over here, looking at the sea of pink going by.
It's so beautiful.
It is beautiful. It's really exciting and wonderful.
So, this is a very small worry in the scheme of things, but it's crossed my mind that the UConn women may win all the marbles.
You think?
And if so, what if they have to come to the White House?
Oh, wow. That is a thought that I haven't really wrapped my brain around.
They wouldn't. In fact, UConn women, if you're listening, I would encourage you very strongly to stand by the principles that you could be proud of, and you have the right and the responsibility to refuse to come to the right house, because it will not be an honor for you in any way to meet with that man.
Nice.
Well, you know, after, yes, very good. After Trump was elected, Gino was quoted, I think, in The Current, saying, how can this be the way he's talked about women? So they may not even get an invitation.
Well, go Gino. You know what's important.
That's right.
Yay, Gino.
So you live in stores.
Yes. Yeah,
wow.
Living in stores is a nice, peaceful place to live.
Yeah, it is.
And it's fun to come to the city and be around a lot of people.
You have such a great attitude. It was pretty kind of crazy making up in the thick of the crowd there.
Oh, yes. We were like, you know, arm in arm trying to creep by.
Trying to stay together.
Do you like my sign?
Donald, it's not too late to change.
It is too late.
Yes, it is. He's an old man. And he's not changing.
Yeah, let's not spend our energy.
What do you think?
What?
Is it ever too late? Is it really?
No, but for him it is.
For him it is.
Not for a normal person, no.
Yeah, for a normal person.
That ship has sailed.
Yeah, I'm afraid so.
Yeah, the best thing that can happen right now is just that damage control.
And maybe justice somewhere somehow is going to prevail. If enough people speak out and enough people refuse to accept what's going on, then maybe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, you're here from Florida.
Dale, get up here.
That's the V.
Dale, you've been elected.
Yeah.
Oh, dear.
You're here from Florida.
I'm here. We are here from Florida in group.
You actually had to buy winter gear.
We bought winter gear. Some of us had bits and pieces. But we live in Florida on purpose so that we don't need this stuff.
Florida, I seem to recall, didn't exactly vote for Hillary.
Well, Florida as a whole did not vote for Hillary.
And many of us don't feel safe there anymore.
Oh, right. Is that true? You don't feel safe there?
No. No, it is. Our little corner particularly was over 90% for that guy.
Black lives matter! Black lives matter! Black lives matter! Black lives matter!
I don't know how much more I can yell.
Yeah.
You know we're going to be yelling.
I need to pace myself.
Megan Hopkins.
Tammy Strauss.
And you're both from Norwalk?
Yes.
Anyone else here from Connecticut? No?
I'm her mother.
Okay.
In Maine.
Maine's way cool.
It is.
So tell me what I just eavesdropped on hearing you say about your being Catholic and how that intersects with your political views.
Well, I'm Catholic. Tammy's not. So I just want to make sure you don't get that. So I believe in the separation of church and state. And I believe that, personally, there are only very few choices where I would make a choice to have an abortion or have, you know, support my daughter in having an abortion if she needed to. I believe that everyone has the right to have one because it's a personal choice, it's your body, and I don't believe that that should be governed. So I think we all should have access to that. So for me, looking at the people who believe that Donald Trump is aligned with their values, I feel bad for them because he's lying and he doesn't really believe in any of this. He's just trying to tell people who have these strong beliefs that he's with them so that they'll vote for him. And he really doesn't care about pro-life. And so people with real beliefs, you know, we have good friends who wanted to find a candidate who aligned with their religious values, and they found him. And I feel like they've been duped.
Are they Catholic?
They're Catholic. Yeah. Yeah, they've been duped. It's sad.
Anything else you want to say?
No, I'm happy to be here.
Even though we're kind of stalled out.
That's okay. We're sold out because so many great people are here. So that's a good thing.
I just had a feed on my phone that said that the crowd is estimated at 500,000.
It's a good number.
It's up from 2. Yeah. Yeah, it's good.
It's great. Thank you. So you guys came here on a bus from Westport.
Yes.
And how was that?
It was great. We left relatively on time. We've all fell asleep.
We had a great captain. Nicole Klein was the bus captain, a volunteer. She kept us all up to date on what was going on, and she brought treats for everybody on the bus, and she was just a really good communicator before we ever got to the bus. I mean, she sent us all these mailings and, you know, what size bags to bring and everything. She was just wonderful. The whole thing is so beautifully organized.
I have a friend who took a bus, and they were going to have wine.
Oh! We were saying some beers and some wine.
And
lattes this morning would have been perfect. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So why is it important to you to have come? I mean, you went to some trouble to get here. I mean, you didn't come from Minnesota.
No.
What did you say, 20 hours?
20 hours. Yeah. We were just talking about it. We came for ourselves, we came for our families, and we came for the women who couldn't be here. You know, other women who had to work today, or they're single moms, or they just had other commitments that they couldn't be here. And we're fortunate enough to have jobs that, you know, that are Monday to Friday, and we have, our husbands didn't let us come, but they certainly supported us in coming and watching our children for the day. So we feel very fortunate and very lucky to be here.
And it's a tribute to the women who've gone before us and done these
things.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. And we feel empowered by this. And the days after the election, I mean, I felt, I was bereft. And Megan cried for days. And we worried about her daughter and her son and my other four grandchildren. And, you know, are they going to grow up thinking it's okay to talk the way Donald Trump talks and to be so rude and a bully? And, I mean, we're teaching them not to be bullies. And now the leader of our country is a bully, an ignorant bully. So this is empowering.
The worst kind.
The energy, the women's energy. We stopped on our way down in Delaware to stretch our legs at 5:00 this morning. And the whole parking area was full of buses, and the rest area, it was all women. Everywhere you looked at 5:00 in the morning, just like smiling like we are now, energized. And, you know, it was just amazing. It just feels so good to do this. You know, I was marching against Vietnam, and my brother was in the war, and, you know, so he came home. But, And my husband and I marched down here in 2002 after Bush invaded Iraq. We came down and marched then. So.
And I'm a third-generation marcher. My grandmother marched with Martin Luther King in Selma.
Yeah, my mom did.
So.
Wow.
Yeah, I grew up in the Episcopal Church, and our bishop in Central New York State mobilized a whole group of people to go down and march in Selma. My mom.
Connecticut rocks.
Yeah,
so really does.
The blue states.
We're so forgotten about. You know, usually we're just kind of wedged between Boston and New York.
Especially,
you know,
Fairfield County.
But, yeah, Fairfield County.
Annex of New York.
Yeah, but we have something to say, and Connecticut matters.
Yeah, people are moving that way.
We're moving. I'm trying to figure out how to get back to Union Station, actually. Do you have any help there?
No clue where that would be from here. No clue whatsoever.
Oh, my gosh. Hi, so what's your name, and tell me where you're from?
My name is Kathy Moore, and I'm from Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Oh, I love Ann Arbor.
Yeah,
I have
I
a good friend
too.
There. We'll have to talk after we're done with this.
Okay.
So you were saying you're a veteran of some many marches, and this one's different. How?
So this is my fourth march in D.C., and I would say that by far this is the largest one. I don't know what the count is, but it feels very much bigger than the other ones I've been a part of.
That's exciting.
Yeah, it's a pretty exciting, all right.
Such a great crowd.
I know.
So sweet and peaceful and kind.
Yes, yes. I was given so much kindness because I got disconnected from my group. And so people just kept reaching out and, you know, making me part of their group. And I met some really nice people. And, you know, it was just wonderful.
Well, have a safe trip home, Kathy Moore.
Thank you. I will.
Kathy Moore and I ended up walking together to the train station, buying T-shirts on the way and agreeing to keep in touch. Thanks to everyone who took part, in person or in spirit, on that wonderful day of marches. And now the work begins. Stay engaged, people. A lot is riding on our speaking up over the next 4 years. Up next is part one of a visit with Rand Richards Cooper, who, along with regular Reasonably Catholic guest Richard Oliva, writes for the Catholic journal Commonweal, and who interviewed Martin Scorsese for the magazine about his latest film, the beautiful yet tough to watch Silence, set in 17th century Japan, a time when Christianity was outlawed. This is Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, coming to you from community-supported Pacifica affiliate WESU-FM, 88.1 Middletown, and WESUFM.org, providing community radio that matters, with the audio posted later this evening at ReasonablyCatholic.com. Back in a moment with more.
Many dogs and cats spend endless days indoors staring at the wall, living for the moment when you will come home and tell them you love them, take them out, and make a fuss over them. Dogs and cats need physical exercise and mental stimulation, things to do and think about in order to be healthy and happy. Please set time aside for them and give them a real life and real love. For more information, please contact People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals at 757-622-PETA. Or helpinganimals.com. That's helpinganimals.com.
Hello, darkness, my old friend. I've come to talk with you again. Because a vision softly creeping left its seeds while I was sleeping. And the vision that was planted in my brain still remains within the sound of silence. In restless dreams.
Welcome, Rand Richards Cooper. What an honor. I've read you many years. I feel like I'm babbling like a baby already, because even from just our email exchange, I can tell this is going to be the most articulate interview ever.
Oh, no. And I'm just the bar is being set high.
Well,
you know, now that email is a long form, I'd like to indulge in it.
We should talk sometime, by the way, about your spiritual practice of not answering emails on the weekends, which sent me into paroxysms of paranoia. What happened? Why does he not want to be on the show anymore? What, did he join the Jesuits? Where'd he go?
Yeah, it's very disturbing when your spiritual practice has to do with technology-related policies, but that's sort of where we are right now.
We're trying to set up an interview here. Where'd he go? It's me, I know.
My spiritual practice consists of ignoring people as much as I possibly can for as long as possible.
Probably. Uh-oh. You could become a saint that way, you know, just ignoring people. I'm going to think about that. All right. Silence. Silence is an odd story, odd maybe to Western readers and viewers, because it's about a very long time ago period and an exotic set of circumstances. Why don't I let you sum up what Silence is about?
So two, I think, obvious points for anyone who's looking for a way into Shusaku Endo. A novelist, I will admit right up front, I knew of his existence, but really hadn't read him before. It's the first novel of his that I have ever read. It was written in 1966. It was his best-known work. He was frequently rumored to be a top candidate for the Nobel Prize. He's sort of the best-known Japanese novelist and the most celebrated Japanese novelist who never won the Nobel Prize. He has been called the Graham Greene of Japanese novelists. Second point about Silence is it's been called one of the great historical novels in our time. So I think if you vector together those two things, the idea of a Japanese Graham Greene and a great historical novel, you sort of have a way into Silence. Endo was a Catholic, and a lot of his writings had to do with the challenge, both in a personal level and also culturally in Japan, of trying to find a path of assimilation or fusion between Catholicism, theologically, and Japanese identity and Japanese culture. And that's really, in a way, what this book is about. It's set in the 17th century, and it takes up a very difficult time and a very interesting time in Japanese history, really right before the closing of Japan to European influence and its famous nearly 200-year closure of Japan. Catholicism had made substantial inroads into Japan in the early 17th century.
Thanks to Francis Xavier.
Right, exactly. And this resulted ultimately in a pretty widespread persecution of Japanese Christians. And that's what this novel takes up. A, the violent persecution of Japanese Christians, and B, the attempts of the protagonists of the novel, two Portuguese Jesuits, to minister to some of those very marginalized Christians, even as they, and this is sort of the central story, the plot, even as they search for a mentor of theirs, another older Jesuit priest named Ferreira, who had gone there decades before. And by the way, Ferreira was an actual historical person. And he had sort of disappeared into Japan. So there's a personal mystery at the core of this story. What happened to Ferreira? The rumors that have filtered back.
It is a little Heart of Darkness.
It is very Heart of Darkness. And that had occurred to me. And when I ultimately spoke with Scorsese, we discussed that a little bit. So these two priests are sort of on the trail of their Kurtz. Ferreira was rumored to have apostatized, to have renounced his faith.
And that's, which no one could believe.
Which like, no
he
one
wouldn't
could
do
believe.
That.
Right. He wouldn't do that. And the act of apostatizing, of renouncing your faith, is very central to the drama of the novel and of the movie. So it's partly a mystery, and really partly a kind of exotic travel adventure, and then very much a theological story, a story about faith and great trials of faith.
So talk about how Scorsese came to be gripped by this.
So part of the way that the movie has been presented and marketed is that it's been this lifelong obsession of Scorsese's. And man, there's so many ways into that that have to do with Scorsese's own Catholicism and his background as a Catholic. But specifically, Scorsese read this book 30 years ago, almost 30 years ago.
On a train. Like you do.
That's correct. He actually read the book on a train on a bullet train in Japan, as you know. But he'd been given the book. This was in 1988. This takes a little bit of unwinding. This was at the time of Scorsese's film, The Last Temptation of Christ. Mm-hmm. As you recall, it was a very controversial film, and there was a lot of religious objection to it.
And because, why don't you sum that up?
Well, because there are a number of reasons that one could object to that film. I don't think it's very good, but
aesthetics aside.
But the religious ones, Jesus is depicted as having fantasized, having dreamed of having a life, a domestic life with Mary. Magdalene, and having children, and there's this extended almost coda to the film in which we see Jesus and Mary years later. He has renounced, in effect, his special role, and has become, you know, a husband and family man. And when you see this in the film, you're not sure, well, what's happening here? Have we morphed into a sort of a counter history, and then you realize at the end we go back to the cross, and this is all a moment's sort of a Ambrose Bierce-like little compressed moment of fantasy. Mm-hmm. So the suggestion of carnality and of erotic desire and erotic relationship that Scorsese gave to Jesus in that film was considered by some to be blasphemous.
To the point of protests,
right?
In
there
the
were
streets.
Many protests, and both here and abroad. He had the film at the Venice Film Festival, and the way he described the scene there was like a mob demonstration. Yeah. So he was forced by people at Paramount to do an airing of this film for various religious leaders, evangelical leaders, people who were opposing the film, as he noted, without having seen it. Yeah. And he felt fairly rattled by this. And so he and his team, after showing this, repaired to a hotel in Manhattan for a dinner and have some drinks. And a guy came up to him, a very imposing, impressive, and engaging man, and said that he had come to the dinner that night because he wanted to assure him, Martin Scorsese, that the film was Christologically correct. Well, that person was Paul Moore, who was the Episcopal bishop of New York at that time. And a very impressive person, a writer, died a number of years ago. And Scorsese tells this story very amusingly and says, Christologically correct. I knew that was good, even though I didn't know exactly what it meant. And he and Paul Moore, who's a very learned man, a theologian in his own right, talked at length about this. And Moore said to him, listen, I have this book about Jesus and about trials of faith by Shusaku Endo, and I think you'd love it, and I want you to read it. So he gave Martin Scorsese the book. And a number of weeks later, Scorsese was shooting another film at that time. I want to say it was Goodfellas, but I'm not sure that makes sense. But anyway, whatever film it was, he was late finishing it, and he rushed then off to Japan because, as you know, he had gotten by a circuitous route a strange invitation, and that is to be in Akira Kurosawa film, to play Vincent Van Gogh in Akira Kurosawa's Dreams. That's a whole nother story. But so as he was hurrying to catch up to Kurosawa, I think on the island of Hokkaido in Japan, he read the entirety of Silence on a train in Japan and completely fell in love with the book. And he then tried for 25 years to make this movie, and it never worked out. There were all sorts of problems, obstacles. Some of them were intellectual property obstacles, lawsuits by people who believed that they should own a piece of this, like the usual stuff that happens. And part of it was his own difficulty in trying to figure out how to make a movie of the material. He talks a bit about that. So, but it became that kind of, you know, great white whale, like you're doing the rest of your life, you're doing like 9 other films, but it's always in the back of your mind, I want to do this movie.
This is an interview with author and journalist Rand Richards Cooper, who spent 2 hours with director Martin Scorsese talking for Commonweal magazine about Scorsese's latest film, Silence, about 2 17th century Jesuit priests who go to Japan to tend to a terrified small flock of Catholics and to look for their former mentor during a time when practicing Christianity was a crime punishable by torture and death. This is Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, coming to you from community-supported Pacifica affiliate WESU-FM, 88.1 Middletown, and WESUFM.org, providing community radio that matters, with the audio posted later this evening at ReasonablyCatholic.com. Back in a moment with more.
I'm Dan Cherubin, the university librarian here at Wesleyan. Both Olin and the Science Library strive to provide safe and accessible spaces where all are free to engage in study, learning, and research. The Wesleyan Libraries are committed to ensuring access to a broad and diverse range of information that is reflective of the histories, cultures, experiences, and perspectives of our community, regardless of gender, race, ethnicity, spiritual choice, sexual orientation or identity, physical ability, and place of origin. We're not just here for homework assignments. We are here for all critical thinkers. For more information, visit www.wesleyan.edu/library.
a message from WESU.
So that story, the story of this being an almost obsessive project of his, is sort of part of the making of this movie.
Talk about it in the scheme of his other work. It's so different. His other work is, shall we say, noisy.
Right.
Anything but silent. And this film has just peace and, well, peace is the wrong word.
Yes, it's interesting. When he talks about this movie, he keeps coming down to the stripped down nature of the experiences that all the main characters are having, and there's the primitive and difficult physical nature of the lives, the peasants, the so-called hidden Christians, who are living in remote areas. Amid considerable poverty, and then there's the stripped down nature of the life that the priests, who now have been underway for months or even years, and how they've been taken away from all the institutional supports. That there's a scene in the beginning where the two. Both of the novel, and by the way, I'm speaking sort of interchangeably of the novel and the movie. The movie is very faithful to the novel, and it follows its events closely. So, for instance, this scene in the beginning, when the two priests are being sent from Macau, where they've been stationed, and their superior is discussing this mission with them and basically trying to dissuade them, and they're in this lovely buildings and surrounded by all sorts of comforts, and the institutions of Jesuit Catholicism are in full array around them, and they're being sent from that to really be the last two functioning priests in remote islands of Japan. And Scorsese was very interested in that, and he keeps coming back to the notions of what do you have when everything else is stripped away from you. The peasants have their physical surroundings are extremely primitive. They don't have devotional objects. There's a good deal in both the novel and the film about the importance to them of sacred devotional objects, and the priests are forced to at one point dismantle their rosaries so they can give each person a bead because they're clamoring for them. So Scorsese recurred when I spoke with him again and again to this notion of when all of these other supports are stripped away from you, what's left? And so it was clear that he saw this film as and that stillness that you referred to as a sort of experiment in radical simplification of the human circumstance. What faith remains when there's nothing but you and it? Yeah. And I think that dictated a certain aesthetic for the film that it's unusual for him. You know, as you said, his films tend to be noisy.
Yeah.
And
although there is the same level of violence.
There is the same level of violence. That is, I mean, if there's one through line in all of his movies, and that's even true in films of his, you know, like Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, in films of his that you don't think of as being violent films, you go back and watch them, there are interludes of shocking violence.
Right.
That's a through line in all of his movies.
What do you make of that?
You know, it is there in the earliest movies of his. His first film. One thing I did preparing for this interview was go back and fill in a lot of the large gaps in my
interview with him, not with me,
in the filmography.
Yeah,
because there were a number of his films that I hadn't seen, and his first film, which was called "Who's That Knocking at My Door," early '60s, and it was. Like Mean Streets, it had Harvey Keitel in it. And I found the first account in the New York Times ever of Martin Scorsese was about his film premiere at NYU, where he was a student. And it, It was called Bring on the Dancing Girls, and that later became Who's That Knocking at My Door? And the New York Times in 1965 describes it this way: this savage, dramatic study of young urban wastrels was written and directed by 22-year-old Martin Scorsese in partial fulfillment for his requirements for his Master of Arts degree. Even with a muffled soundtrack and a reel-changing snag, the raw vitality of Mr. Scorsese's screen work attested to the fertile imagination and distinct graphic skill in his chosen profession. This raw vitality, which from the beginning of his films has to do really with male violence, male camaraderie, with a sort of male assertions of life in urban settings, and there's always a sense from early on that celebration of that, that there's an ambiguity to that, because there's celebration of it, but you know, things in Scorsese movies will quickly turn, and what seems like guys partying suddenly turns into guys beating the hell out of each other.
Do I amuse you?
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
And it's also tied in those early movies with a casual misogyny that's deeply embedded in and which obviously was of great interest to him from the get-go. But the way he works this out in his early movies, often there's this sort of high-low cultural impulse. So you'll get soundtracks in which like opera arias are tied to like rock and roll. I mean, one of the great elements of Scorsese's synthetic genius is that he's able to make these seemingly opposite impulses coexist together in his films. But in Silence, this stripped down spiritual plight and the dilemmas that he attaches to it are clearly something that dictated a different way of having the film feel. He focused a lot on the pacing. It's a much slower film.
Yeah.
Than, I don't know, I'm trying to think of another Scorsese film that even remotely approaches that.
You know, I didn't see the one about Buddhism.
Kundun. Yeah.
Does that have a kind of...
That's one of the, I think, three or four films of his that I still haven't seen.
Mm-hmm. What about the documentary about George Harrison?
That he alludes to at the end. Right.
Does that have that kind of slow, meditative...
I don't know. I haven't seen
we'll
either.
We'll have to go see those.
Yeah, right.
We'll have to find them.
But, I mean, Last Temptation of Christ is nothing like this. Last Temptation of Christ is very talky.
Yeah.
You've seen it?
I did. It's so long ago, I can barely remember it.
It's very talky, and interestingly, he chose in that film not to adopt the normal kind of accent conventions that adhere to biblical epics, where you have people sound sort of British or vaguely some hodgepodge like they've done in Silence.
Right.
You know, these are American actors, some of them, but they don't sound like it.
No.
It's effective. They've adopted these sort of continental accents. You can't quite pin them down, right? I mean, it's sort of British, sort of maybe Portuguese.
I think the Times Review actually complained about that. It was all over the map.
I'm not, maybe it is. But I'm not complaining about that if the sort of baseline comparison is Last Temptation of Christ, in which Harvey Keitel, as Judas, it's like, Jesus, they're going to hate you. They're going to hate you, Jesus. And I mean, honestly, I watched them and no, I love Harvey Keitel.
It
doesn't work. And to have Adam Driver, I'm doing that thing again. Here it is.
You're forgiven, my child.
Thank you. I think that both Andrew Garfield and Adam Driver came up with sufficiently ambiguous accents of sufficiently ambiguous provenance and also sort of mellifluous. So I thought it went well. And then the only thing that bothered me accent wise, Liam Neeson plays Ferreira. He plays the Kurtz-like character. And so he's absent for much of the film, and finally his presence is revealed. I won't give away too much of it. But at this point of Liam Neeson's career, of course, he's a great actor, but he's now done so many of those Taken movies that I associate that rough, gravelly, vaguely Irish voice of his with, you keep expecting him to say things like, "I'm coming to get my daughter." "I'm taking my daughter," and that sense of violent urgency that has now, in my mind and to my ear, become so wholly tagged with that particular role that he plays.
You know, since we're talking about the voices, the Japanese guy who plays the Inquisitor, he has this little evil voice. He sounds like
he's great, isn't he?
Isn't he great?
I don't know the actor's name, but it's a brilliant. A brilliant spot of casting.
You know who I thought of? I thought of one of those high priests in Superstar.
Right. The one who plays like Anis.
Yeah.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm just trying to think of the line of Jesus Christ. I know that sort of weaselly voice. And
Caiaphas, right. The council hates me.
Right. A gentleman. You know why we are here. Right. Then the guy goes like, "Cut the protesting." That guy. That guy. And I think that part was well cast and well written, because that Inquisitor plays a particular role, and it's one of a kind of intellectual torment, right. and mockery.
Right.
And his genial friendliness is partly a way to try to plant fingers inside the mind and the heart of Father Rodriguez, Andrew Garfield's character.
If you're just joining us, this is a chat with Rand Richards Cooper about his in-depth interview with Martin Scorsese for Commonweal magazine, all about the new film Silence, which is about what becomes of faith when everything else is stripped away. This is Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, coming to you from community-supported Pacifica affiliate WESU-FM, 88.1 Middletown, and WESUFM.org, providing community radio that matters, with the audio posted later this evening, along with photos from the Women's March on Washington, at reasonablycatholic.com. Back in a moment.
Millions of people all over the world go hungry while we waste our land and water resources. Did you know that raising animals for human consumption uses 8 times as much water as growing fruits, vegetables, and grains? And that the same amount of land can produce 17 times more soybean protein than meat protein? If you care about animals, good health, and the earth, please consider becoming a vegetarian. The lives you save may include your own. For free, tasty vegetarian recipes and a DVD, call PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, at 1-888-VEG-FOOD. That's 1-888-VEG-FOOD. Visit online at GoVeg.com. That's GoVeg.com. This message has been sponsored by PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. Thank you.
The way that this works, by the way, for those who are listening, I don't think this gives too much away, is that after a time spent ministering to the hidden Christians on a couple of Japanese islands, they're caught. The two priests are caught. Garupe, played by Adam Driver in the movie, and Rodriguez, the main character, played by Andrew Garfield. And then they are forced. At that point in the evolution of, and this is, I think, historically accurate, the evolution of this persecution of Japanese Christians, the feudal, Japanese feudal lords had moved from killing the priests to attempting to get them to renounce publicly. That was seen as a more powerful means of debilitating the spiritual impulse among Christians. And so they were then forced to watch their congregations being tormented. And they were, the demand was that they publicly renounce their faith, and that they do so in a particularly symbolically trenchant way, and that is by stepping on, either stepping on or spitting on an image of Christ, which is Japanese called a fumie. And it's usually a bronze engraved image of either the crucifix or sometimes it's with the Virgin Mary. So you are asked to publicly to defile that image. And if they don't do it, really bad things are going to happen. So the theological and personal drama at the center of this involves the decision of whether to do that or not, which I think for a modern audience is a little bit of a hump to get over.
You say that in your interview. I like that you asked, you know, obviously the audience is going to think, yeah, step on it, you're saving people's lives.
Right.
You know.
Which is the place that it ultimately gets around to. But
don't give it away.
Yeah. Well, I won't say how that happens.
Yeah.
But one of the challenges, I think, for Endo in the novel and for Scorsese making the film is to get you into a mindset that's different from the one that we're in here, because we watch it and, well, I don't know if you did, but I did. I thought, like, listen, if they're going to torture and kill these people, and if you can step on the image of Christ and save them, do it, because
Christ would second the motion.
Right. And, you know, keep your own internal arrangements, you know, keep your fingers crossed in your mind and say, you know, I'm doing it. But so there's clearly a pre-modern mindset and bearing on the issue of public declarations, the public declarative aspect of faith, the meaning of symbolic renunciation, particularly for a priest, the importance of that priest's remaining publicly faithful, the importance of that to his flock, the things that are worse than death.
Yeah.
And the history of the saints is full of people who paid stiff price for not renouncing their faith. And somewhere in reading about, I don't know, Endo's novel or about the movie, I came across the story of, I think it was Saint Teresa Perpetua, who would not renounce her faith, and her father, who was a pagan, was begging her to do this. I think the idea was, if you don't, you're never going to see your family or children again. And she, according to the story, holds up this vase and says to him, you see this vase? It is a vase. I can no more be not a Christian than this vase can be not a vase. Mm. Or vase. Do you say vase or vase?
I'm a vase person.
Yes. Do you know any of the vase people?
I think they're dying out.
They are. That might not be a bad thing. So there is that sense, and that requires an effort of imagination for all of us.
Did Scorsese acknowledge such when you asked him that?
He did. That was one of the times when he changed the subject a little bit.
Mm-hmm. We're going to get to, by the way, listeners, what it was like to interview Martin Scorsese, which could be an episode in itself. So you don't really remember what he said about how we have to make a little mental shift to get the context of that time.
Yeah, he agreed with that. He agreed with that, but I don't think he saw it as much of a problem as I did.
Yeah.
And I've seen the film twice, and I still feel that way a bit. But that's good. I mean, if you're writing a great historical novel, or making a great historical movie, I mean, history is not simply a recording of what happened next, right? History is a recording of what the human being was like in a time significantly different from and prior to ours.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, you know, that's a horse of a different color in terms of a challenge, because some things are that happened 400 years ago are going to be alien to us because the world looks different. So I take it as a virtue of this film that it works hard to get us there.
Well, since we're talking
and
about
movie,
the virtues.
The book too, yeah.
What did you think as a critic? Because, like, our usual film critic, Richard Oliva, our Common Wheel guest.
My colleague.
You too, yes. And thanks, Richard, for connecting us. What did you think of the film?
I liked it a lot.
Do you have to say that because you interviewed Martin Scorsese friends?
No, yeah. You know, it's always fun to interview someone and know that 10 minutes after you walk out, they're not going to know who you are. And there's something quite liberating about that.
Like, you think that's true?
I do. Oh, absolutely. Come on, you're Martin Scorsese. You're going around just... I was lucky to get 2 hours with him. That was great. But many people will get a lot less.
Do you think you got it because he respects the publication or because he knows your work?
Certainly not that, but I think there are a couple of things. First, I know that he's concerned about whether there's an audience for this movie.
Ah.
It's
not like any of the others in the trailers.
Right. So he understands that that a Catholic audience is going to come to this film with an already well established interest in this, and a religious audience generally, then he knows about our magazine. Common Wheel is a small magazine, but it's a magazine with a very interesting, long, and even glorious history. And we have interviewed him before. We interviewed him well before my time, but 30 years ago, when Last Temptation of Christ came out. In fact, he remembered that interview well.
Good or for ill?
For good. It was a very smart interview. And so I think normally we probably, a magazine of our size, wouldn't be able to get him. But I think he has a little soft spot for the magazine, and he was looking for religiously engaged audiences. Because, you know, this movie is a very hard sell. We're going to follow two priests through 17th century Japan in their captivity and isolation as they wrestle with theological issues of faith. Oh, absolutely. Yes.
Do you think that's the reason, it sounds stupid to even ask, but even given his many successes, do you think that's the reason he couldn't get this film made for so many years?
Yeah. I mean, first of all, almost no one else is getting this film made. So, yeah. And I forget what the budget was, but the budget was not small. Mm. And if you're going to get this film made at all, you know, if you're sort of nobody, you're not going to have any real money for this film. So he's the guy. And you've noticed, I mean, they're keeping spending down to a minimum. You notice how the TV commercials, of which you've begun to see some, they're so short. they're like
quick before
20 second commercial, you know, blah 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 blah, long commercial for this or that. We watch the nightly news, so you know, yeah, all the, you know, the
medicine,
usual products. So it's like like 55 seconds on Cialis and then silence. Whoa, filmed by Martin Scorsese, boom, and then, you know, then we're back to all our various maladies. And since I tend to fast forward over the commercials, yeah, I mean, the silence is like you just quickly see Adam Driver's face and then we're out of there. So I think and there isn't much sense so far that a lot of attention is going to be paid. You know, it sort of got stiffed at the Golden Globes and
oh yeah, and we're going to see, yet as we're talking, the Oscar nominations haven't been announced.
Right.
What do you think will happen?
So I haven't been paying that much attention this year, but my sense is that maybe, you know, it gets a cinematography nomination. That the cinematographer Rodrigo Prieto is terrific. It's
beautiful.
It's a beautiful film.
Yes,
it's hard to watch in places, but I would say it's visually opulent.
Yeah.
That's not a Scorsese hallmark, really. Yep. Character, dialogue, music, actually soundtrack is more important. Has typically been more important to him, I think, than the look of his films. Scorsese had an idea of a feeling, a look that nature should have, which is sort of all enveloping, with lavish, you know, with a potential for something a little bit suffocating, but mm-hmm, essentially beautiful. Yeah. And he's very funny about that, Scorsese. He says, you know, I'm not a rustic person. Yes. He said, like, I grew up like an asthmatic kid, you know, in a room looking out a window at brick walls. I'm a city guy. So I really didn't know what to do with this. And he sort of delivered a lot of that over. He had certain ideas, certain angles he wanted, and a certain feel.
That was part one of a talk with author and journalist Rand Richards Cooper about his in-depth interview with director Martin Scorsese about the new film Silence. I'll post the entire uncut interview at the ReasonablyCatholic.com blog next Tuesday. Today's portion of our chat, plus a link to Rand's Q&A with Scorsese and Commonweal, will be posted there this evening, along with photos from the Women's March on Washington. I'm Maria Johnson. Thanks for listening. Now stay tuned for The Jive at 5, followed by Acoustic Blender with Bill Revel.